Adopting structured learning methods. Once you have a rough sense of what you need to learn and where to seek it, whether from reports or from conversations with knowledgeable people, the next step is to understand how best to learn. Many managers' inclination is to dive in and start talking to people. You will pick up much soft information this way, but this method is not efficient. Why? Because it can be time-consuming, and because its lack of structure makes it difficult to know how much weight to place on various individuals' observations. Your views may be shaped excessively by the first few people, or last few, with whom you talk, and people may seek you out early precisely so they can influence you. Thus, you should consider using a structured learning process designed for new leaders. To illustrate the advantages of a structured approach, imagine that you plan to meet with your direct reports to elicit their assessments of the situation. How might you go about doing this? Bringing them together right away might be a mistake, because some will hesitate to reveal their views in a public forum. Instead, you decide to meet them one-on-one. Of course, this has its drawbacks too, because you have to meet people in some order. You should therefore expect that the people who are later on your schedule will be talking to the earlier ones to try to get a sense of what you are after. This may both reduce your ability to gain a range of views about what is going on and allow others to interpret your messages in ways you might not intend. Suppose that you decide to meet with your direct reports one-on-one. In what order will you meet them? And how will you avoid being excessively influenced by what the first couple of people say to you? One approach is to keep the same script in all your meetings. Its format might consist of brief opening remarks about yourself and your approach, followed by questions about the other person, background, family, and interests, and then a standard set of questions about the business. This approach is powerful because the responses you get are comparable. You can line them up side by side and analyze what is consistent and inconsistent about the responses. This helps you gain insight into which people are being more or less open. When diagnosing a new organization, start by meeting your direct reports one-on-one. This is an example of taking a horizontal slice across an organization by interviewing people at the same level in different functions. Ask them essentially the same 5 questions. Number 1. What are the biggest challenges the organization is facing or will face in the near future? Number 2. Why is the organization facing or going to face these challenges? Number 3. What are the most promising unexploited opportunities for growth? Number 4. What would need to happen for the organization to exploit the potential of these opportunities? Number 5. If you were me, what would you focus your attention on? These 5 questions, coupled with careful listening and thoughtful follow-up, are certain to elicit many insights. By asking everyone the same set of questions, you can identify prevalent and divergent views and thus avoid being swayed by the first or most forceful or articulate person you talk to. How people answer can also tell you a lot about your new team and its politics. Who answers directly and who is evasive or prone to going on tangents? Who takes responsibility and who points fingers? Who has a broad view of the business and who seems stuck in a silo? Once you have distilled these early discussions into a set of observations, questions, and insights, convene your direct reports as a group, feedback your impressions and questions, and invite some discussion. You will learn more about both substance and team dynamics by doing so, and will simultaneously demonstrate how quickly you have begun to identify key issues. You need not follow this process rigidly. You could, for example, get an outside consultant to do some diagnosis of the organization and feedback the results to your group. See New Leader Assimilation Process. Or you can invite an internal facilitator to run the process. The point is that even a modest amount of structure, a script, and a sequence of interactions, such as meeting with people individually, doing some analysis, and then meeting with them together, can dramatically accelerate your ability to extract actionable insights. Naturally, the questions you will ask will be tailored specifically for the groups you meet. If you are meeting with salespeople, for example, consider asking, "What do our customers want that they are getting from our competitors and not getting from us?" Other structured learning methods are valuable in particular situations. Some of the methods described in Table 2-1, which is in the PDF document on the final CD of this program, may increase the efficiency of your learning process depending on your level in the organization and the type of business situation you were in. Effective new leaders employ a combination of methods, tailoring their learning strategy to the demands of the situation. New leader assimilation processes. One example of a structured learning method is the new leader assimilation process, originally developed by GE. In this process, each time a manager enters a significant new role, he or she is assigned a transition facilitator. The facilitator meets first with the new leader to lay out the process. This is followed by a meeting with the leader's new direct reports, in which they are asked questions such as, what would you like to know about the new leader? What would you like him or her to know about you? About the business situation? The main findings are then fed back, without attribution, to the new leader. The process ends with a facilitated meeting between the new leader and the direct reports. Creating a learning plan. Your learning agenda defines what you want to learn. Your learning plan defines how you will go about learning it. It translates learning goals into specific sets of actions, identifying promising sources of insight and using systematic methods that accelerate your learning. Your learning plan is a critical part of your 90-day plan. In fact, as we will discuss later, learning should be a primary focus of your plan for your first 30 days on the job. The heart of your learning plan is a cyclical learning process in which you collect information, analyze and distill it, develop hypotheses, and test them, thus progressively deepening your understanding of your new organization. Obviously, the specific insights you decide to pursue will vary from situation to situation. You can begin by listening critically to the learning plan template in the accompanying narrative and deciding which elements make sense for you, which do not, and what is missing. In the next chapter, we will explore different types of transition situations and return to the subject of what you need to learn and when. Learning plan template. Before entry, number one, read whatever you can find about the organization's strategy, structure, performance, and people. Number two, look for external assessments of the performance of the organization. You will learn how knowledgeable, fairly unbiased people view the organization. If you are a manager at a lower level, talk to people who deal with your new group as suppliers or customers. Number three, find external observers who know the organization well, including former employees, recent retirees, and people who have transacted business with the organization. Ask these people open-ended questions about the organization's history, politics, and culture. Talk with your predecessor if possible. Number four, talk to your new boss. Number five, as you begin to learn about the organization, write down your first impressions and eventually some hypotheses. Number six, compile an initial set of questions to guide your structured inquiry once you arrive. Soon after entry. Number one, review detailed operating plans, performance data, and personnel data. Number two, meet one-on-one with your direct reports and ask them the questions you compiled. You will learn about convergent and divergent views and about them as people. Number three, assess how things are going at key interfaces from the inside. You will hear how salespeople, purchasing agents, customer service representatives, and others perceive your organization's dealings with external constituencies. You will also learn about problems they see that others do not. Number four, test strategic alignment from the top down. Ask people at the top what the company's vision and strategy are. Then see how far down into the organizational hierarchy those beliefs penetrate. You will learn how well the previous leader drove vision and strategy down through the organization. Number five, test awareness of challenges and opportunities from the bottom up. Start by asking frontline people how they view the company's challenges and opportunities. Then work your way up. You will learn how well the people at the top check the pulse of the organization. Number six, update your questions and hypotheses. Number seven, meet with your boss to discuss your hypotheses and findings. By the end of the first month, number one, gather your team to feedback your preliminary findings. You will elicit confirmations and challenges of your assessments and will learn more about the group and its dynamics. Number two, now analyze key interfaces from the outside in. You will learn how people on the outside, suppliers, customers, distributors, and others, perceive your organization and its strengths and weaknesses. Number three, analyze a couple of key processes. Convene representatives of the responsible groups to map out and evaluate the processes you selected. You will learn about productivity, quality, and reliability. Number four, meet with key integrators. You will learn how things work at interfaces among functional areas within the company. What problems do they perceive that others do not? Seek out natural historians. They can fill you in on the history, culture, and politics of the organization, and they are also potential allies and influencers. Number five, update your questions and hypotheses. Number six, meet with your boss again to discuss your observations. Learning about culture. Your most vexing business problems likely will have a cultural dimension. In some cases, you will find that aspects of the existing culture are key impediments to realizing high performance. You will thus have to struggle to change them. Other aspects of the culture will turn out to be functional and thus worthy of preservation. Having realized how proud and motivated the workforce was, Chris Bagley could draw on this energy to upgrade the plant. Think how much more difficult it would have been had he inherited a group of complacent, hostile people. Because cultural habits and norms operate powerfully to reinforce the status quo, it is vital to diagnose problems in the existing culture and to figure out how to begin to address them. These assessments are particularly important if you are coming in from the outside or joining a unit within your existing organization that has a strong subculture. You can't hope to change your organization's work culture if you don't understand it. One useful framework for analyzing an organization's work culture approaches it at three levels: symbols, norms, and assumptions. Symbols are signs, including logos and styles of dress. They distinguish one culture from another and promote solidarity. Are there distinctive symbols that signify your unit and help members recognize one another? Norms are shared social rules that guide right behavior. What behaviors get encouraged or rewarded in your unit? What elicits scorn or disapproval? Assumptions are the often unarticulated beliefs that pervade and underpin social systems. These beliefs are the air that everyone breathes. What truths does everyone take for granted? To understand a culture, you must peer below the surface of the symbols and norms and get at the underlying assumptions. To do this, you need to carefully watch the way people interact with one another. For instance, do people seem most concerned with individual accomplishment and reward, or are they more focused on group accomplishment? Does the group seem more casual or more formal, more aggressive and hard-driving, or more laid-back? As my colleague Jerry Augustino noted, the most relevant assumptions for new leaders involves power and value. Regarding power, key questions are as follows. Who do key people in your organization think they can legitimately exercise authority and make decisions? What does it take to earn your stripes? Regarding value, what actions are believed by employees to create and destroy value? At White Goods, employees were proud of producing premium quality products, so a decision to move down market could easily trigger resistance. Divergent assumptions about power and value, for example, between workers and managers, can complicate efforts to align the organization. Some degree of divergence is, of course, unavoidable. The danger comes when the gap becomes too wide to be bridged by effective communication and negotiation. Organizational, professional, and geographic perspectives. You can also think about culture from three perspectives: organizational, professional, and geographic. As you read the following descriptions, imagine examining each aspect of culture through a camera's zoom lens. Start by zooming in to see organizational culture, then gradually widen your focus to see professional culture, and then focus broadly on geographic culture. Organizational culture. Cultures within organizations or groups develop over time and can be deeply rooted. Organizational culture is expressed in the way people treat one another: friendly, formal, relaxed. The values they share: honesty, competitiveness, hard work. The routines they follow as they hold meetings and exchange information, and so on. Organizational cultures vary within and across industries. For example, managers in an established, traditional consumer products company may be comfortable with more elaborate processes and systems than managers in a startup in the same industry. An energy industry executive might feel he's on shaky ground working in a fashion retail company. Professional culture. Managers as a group also share cultural characteristics that distinguish them from other professional groups, such as engineers, administrative assistants, and doctors or teachers. But this doesn't mean all managers are alike. In fact, you've probably seen huge cultural differences within and between business functions. For example, financial managers have different worldviews than marketing or R&D managers. In part, this is because the people who gravitate towards these functions have different professional training. Geographic culture. Geographic changes can present the greatest diversity in culture. The way people do business in different regions of a country can vary significantly. Differences in business cultures between two countries are even more pronounced. For example, U.S. managers tend to work within a more individualistic culture, whereas Japanese managers stress more collectivist values and behaviors. Moving into new cultures. If you're moving to a new company within the same industry, or to a new industry, from financial services to food management, for example, you'll likely confront organizational cultural changes. Your new position may take you to a different functional arena, for example, from operations to marketing, or to a whole new level of responsibility, for instance, from a functional area to general management. In such cases, you will face professional cultural changes, differences that are significant even when you move to a new position within the same organization. If you're taking a position with a division in your company that is located in a different city or region in your country, or in another country, you'll likely face geographic cultural changes. These different kinds of culture change can overlap and reinforce one another. See Figure 2-2, which is in the PDF document on the final CD of this program. For instance, if you move to a new company that's also in a new city or region, you'll face organizational and geographic culture changes. It is useful to assess your cultural adaptation challenge on a scale of 1 to 10 on each of these three dimensions. On the organizational cultural dimension, a 10 would be a move from a highly centralized, process-focused organization to a highly decentralized, relationship-focused organization. On the professional culture dimension, a 10 would be a move from finance to human resources, or vice versa. Finally, on the geographic dimension, a 10 would be a move from Minneapolis to Tokyo. If the total of these three numbers is 15 or greater, then you are facing a major cultural shift. To avoid missteps, you must devote significant energy to understanding and adapting to the new culture or cultures. Adaptation or alteration. After identifying the organizational culture to which you're moving, you need to decide whether to adapt or to alter that culture. Whatever your situation, you'll need to understand the impact of existing cultural characteristics on your new situation. In particular, you'll want to assess which cultural characteristics are helping performance and which may be harming performance. Your future success depends on knowing the difference and taking the proper action. Closing the loop. Your learning priorities and strategies will inevitably shift as you dig deeper. As you start to interact with your new boss, or to figure out where to get some early wins, or to build supportive coalitions, it will be critical for you to gain additional insights. So plan to return to this chapter periodically to reassess your learning agenda and create new learning plans. Acceleration checklist. Number 1. Are you effective at learning about new organizations? Do you sometimes fall prey to the action imperative? To coming in with the answer? If so, how will you avoid doing this? Number 2. What is your learning agenda? Based on what you know now, compose a list of questions to guide your early inquiry. If you've begun to form hypotheses about what is going on, what are they and how will you test them? Number 3. Given the questions you want to answer, which individuals are most likely to provide you with solid, actionable insights? Number 4. How might you increase the efficiency of your learning process? What are some ways you might extract more actionable insights for your investment of time and energy? Number 5. Given your answers to the previous questions, start to create your learning plan. Chapter 3. Match strategy to situation. When Claire Weeks stepped into her new role as head of the Industrial Products Division of a large multinational company, she believed the division had enough strength to continue to achieve double-digit earnings growth. Growth had been strong over the past 4 years, and the division had several promising products in the pipeline. Based on her early assessments, Claire committed herself to achieving the ambitious goals laid out in her predecessor's plan. Claire soon discovered the situation was less rosy. The division's stellar past performance masked structural problems with pricing, inventories, and strained distributor relationships. It seemed that her predecessor had been mortgaging the division's future to make himself look good. Although not mortal threats, these problems made it difficult for Claire to meet her targets. Rather than go to the CEO, explain the problems, and take the hit, however, she elected to push forward. She believed that she could eke out enough growth through price increases and acquisitions to keep results on track until a new key product was launched. Struggling to achieve the goals she had committed herself to, Claire made a series of avoidable missteps that eroded her credibility. She alienated the company's distributors by forcing through price increases. She made a couple of bad calls trying to speed up critical new product launches. As it became obvious that she would not meet her targets through organic growth, she tried and failed to make a significant acquisition. Claire's problems flowed from a mistaken diagnosis of the situation. Believing that she was in a sustaining success situation, she signed on to overly ambitious growth targets. In reality, the company was in need of a significant realignment. Rather than confront the need for realignment and reset expectations, Claire became a victim of her own short-sightedness. She resigned when it became clear the CEO had lost confidence in her ability to lead the division. Far too many new leaders like Claire Weeks do a poor job of diagnosing their situations and tailoring their strategies accordingly. Then, because they misunderstood the situation, they make unnecessary mistakes like Claire's commitment to unachievable earnings goals. This painful scenario continues to recur because people typically model their own transitions on a limited set of experiences. If you're like Claire, you've learned to make transitions the hard way. You've made mistakes along the way, and you've learned from them. If you're fortunate, bosses, mentors, and advisors have shared their hard-won experience with you. Over time, you've probably fixed on some must-dos and do-not-dos. It is worth being clear about them up front, so you can evaluate which hold up in your new situation and which do not. Consider taking some time to summarize your own rules of thumb for making a successful transition before you listen further. Now step back and assess how robust and actionable these insights are. Your recent move suggests that your approach has worked well up to this point, but it won't necessarily continue to work if you are moving to a different level or entering an unfamiliar business situation. Even if you have had broad exposure to managerial disciplines, marketing, operations, R&D, and finance, your experience with different kinds of business situations, startup, turnaround, realignment, and sustaining success may still be narrow. By methodically diagnosing the situation, Claire Weeks could have avoided her problems. Matching your strategy to your situation requires careful diagnosis of the business situation. Only then can you be clear-headed, not just about the challenges, but also about the opportunities and resources available to you. Diagnosing the business situation. The four broad types of business situations that new leaders must contend with are startup, turnaround, realignment, and sustaining success. From now on, we will refer to this framework of transition types as the STARS model. An outline of the characteristics of each of these types and their associated challenges and opportunities will help you to recognize the key structural features of your own situation. What are the defining features of each of the four STARS situations? In a startup, you are charged with assembling the capabilities, people, funding, and technology to get a new business, product, or project off the ground. In a turnaround, you take on a unit or group that is recognized to be in trouble and work to get it back on track. Both startups and turnarounds involve much resource-intensive construction work. There isn't much existing infrastructure and capacity for you to build on. To a significant degree, you get to start fresh, but both require that you start making tough calls early. Realignments and sustaining success situations, by contrast, are situations in which you enter organizations that have significant strengths but also serious constraints on what you can and cannot do. In realignment, your challenge is to revitalize a unit, product, process, or project that is drifting into trouble. In a sustaining success situation, you are shouldering responsibility for preserving the vitality of a successful organization and taking it to the next level. Put another way, in realignments, you have to reinvent the business. In sustaining success situations, you have to invent the challenge. In both situations, you typically have some time before you need to make major calls, which is good news because you have to learn a lot about the culture and politics and begin building supportive coalitions. Applying these categories to business situations is useful regardless of your level in the organization. You may be a new CEO taking over an entire company that is in startup mode. Or you could be a first-line supervisor managing a new production line, a brand manager launching a new product, an R&D team leader responsible for a new product development project, or an information technology manager responsible for implementing a new enterprise software system. All of these situations share the characteristics of a startup. Turnovers, realignments, and sustaining success situations also arise at all levels, in companies large and small. Understanding the history. The relationships among these four business situations are depicted in the STARS model of business evolution depicted in Figure 3-1, which is in the PDF document on the final CD of this program. The key point is that businesses, and for that matter, projects, processes, products, and plants, tend to move predictably from one type of situation to another. Understanding the history of your new organization will help you grasp the challenges and opportunities of your situation. Let us start, fittingly, with startups. Successful startups grow and eventually become sustaining success situations. Often, the individuals who manage the startup move on to tackle new startups, and managers more experienced at running larger businesses take over. These successful businesses may in turn give birth to internal startups as they diversify into new products, services, processes, or technologies. In this way, healthy companies enter a growth cycle. But entropy increases. Successful businesses tend, because of internal complacency or external challenges, or both, to drift towards trouble. Even if the organization is not yet in crisis, acute observers see gathering storm clouds that signal a need for realignment. This was the situation facing Claire Weeks, who failed to recognize it early enough. Realigning an organization usually means redirecting its resources, such as by abandoning aging product lines and developing new technologies. It often means changing the organization's strategy, structure, skills, and even its culture in fundamental ways. Realigning the business returns it to a sustaining success state, designated in the model as the recovery cycle. One of the main hurdles of realignment is that many in such organizations, like Claire Weeks, are in denial about the situation. They continue to believe they are sustaining success even as they are heading for trouble. If efforts to realign the business fail, it can end as a full-scale turnaround. This happens when prior leaders failed to see the need for realignment. After all, businesses rarely go directly from sustaining success to turnaround. No matter why this happened, there is rarely argument about the need to make big changes fast if the situation is dire, the business is losing money, and its best talent is jumping ship. Turning around a failing business requires the new leader to cut it down to a defendable core fast and then begin to build it back up. This painful process, if successful, leaves the business in a sustaining success situation, as illustrated by the crisis cycle in Figure 3-1, which is in the PDF document on the final CD of this program. If efforts to turn around the business fail, the result is shutdown or divestiture. It is important to understand these cycles. You cannot figure out where to take a new organization if you do not understand where it has been and how it got where it is. In a realignment, for example, it is essential to understand what made the organization successful in the past and why it drifted into trouble. To understand your situation, you have to put on your historian's hat. Identifying challenges and opportunities. In all four of the STARS situations, the eventual goal is the same, a successful and growing business. But each type of transition presents a distinct set of challenges. If you are succeeding the leader of a high-performing business, the challenge will be to take charge in your own way while preserving what is good about the organization. If you are in a startup situation, such as getting a new product off the ground, you will be responsible for creating the organization. If you're in a realignment situation, you will have to build awareness of the need for change. Each situation also presents characteristic opportunities that you can leverage to build momentum. In a turnaround situation, everyone realizes that changes need to be made quickly. That group awareness can help you move forward. In realignment situations, such as Claire Weeks, the organization is still likely to have strong people, products, and technologies. By finding these islands of excellence, you can marshal the building blocks to make needed changes. Although every situation is unique, each of the four types of transitions exhibits distinct challenges and opportunities, summarized in Table 3-1, which is in the PDF document and the final CD of this program. Transforming Organizational Psychology. People's attitudes and emotions vary in predictable ways depending on which of the STARS situations they are experiencing. Participants in a startup are likely to be more excited and hopeful than members of a troubled group facing failure. But at the same time, employees of a startup are typically much less focused on key issues than those in a turnaround, simply because the vision, strategy, structures, and systems that channel organizational energy are not yet in place. Participants in a turnaround often know what the problems are, but not what to do about them. Success at transitioning, therefore, depends, in part, on your ability to transform the prevailing organizational psychology in predictable ways. In startups, the prevailing mood is often one of excited confusion, and your job is to channel that energy into productive directions, in part by deciding what not to do. In turnarounds, you may be dealing with a group of people who are close to despair. It is your job to provide a light at the end of the tunnel. In realignments, you will likely have to pierce through the veil of denial that is preventing people from confronting the need to reinvent the business. Finally, in sustaining success situations, you have to invent the challenge by finding ways to keep people motivated, to combat complacency, and to find new direction for growth, both organizational and personal. Leading with the right skills. The management skills necessary for success vary among the four STARS situations. Startups and turnarounds call for hunters, people who can move fast and take chances. In turnarounds, for example, the premium is on rapid diagnosis of the business situation, markets, technologies, products, and strategies, and then aggressive moves to cut back the organization to a defendable core. You will need to act quickly and decisively, often on the basis of incomplete information. The skills that contribute to success in realignment and sustaining success situations, by contrast, are more akin to farming than hunting. More subtle influence skills come into play. Skilled farmers focus on understanding the culture and politics of the organization. They also painstakingly cultivate awareness of the need for change by promoting shared diagnoses, influencing opinion leaders, and encouraging benchmarking. To put it another way, in turnarounds, the problems teach the people about the need for major changes. In realignments, by contrast, you must teach people about the problems. Turnarounds are also ready, fire, aim situations. You make the tough calls with less than full knowledge and then adjust as you learn more. Realignments and sustaining success assignments are ready, aim, fire situations. Time urgency is less extreme, but it is more important to understand the organization, get the strategy right, and build support for it, and make some good early calls. Because of their differing imperatives, it is easy for hunters to stumble in realignment and sustaining success situations, and for farmers to stumble in startups and turnarounds. The experienced turnaround person facing a realignment is at risk of arriving with the answer and moving too fast, needlessly causing resistance. The experienced realignment person in a turnaround situation is at risk of moving too slowly, expending energy on cultivating consensus when it is unnecessary to do so, thus squandering precious time. This is not to say that people who are good at hunting cannot farm or vice versa. Good managers can succeed in all four of the STARS situations, though no one is equally good at all of them. But it is essential to think hard-headedly about which of your skills and inclinations will serve you well in your particular situation and which are likely to get you into trouble. Don't arrive with your spear if you need to be plowing. Focusing your energy. Achieving clarity about the type of situation you are confronting helps you decide what you need to do in your first 90 days. In particular, clarity helps you to make three fundamental early choices. Number one, how much emphasis will you place on learning as opposed to doing? Number two, how much emphasis will you place on offense as opposed to defense? And number three, what should you do to get some early wins? Learning versus doing. How much time should you devote to deepening your understanding of your new organization as opposed to making decisions, initiating changes, recruiting new people, and so on? The correct balance of learning and doing differs strikingly in the four STARS situations. In turnarounds and startups, the premium is on doing. You have to make some early calls without full information. If you spend too much time learning, events will overtake you and create a vicious cycle. You will have to fire before you are certain of your aim and then adjust accordingly. This is not to say that learning is unimportant in turnarounds and startups, but the learning required in these situations is fundamentally technical in nature, It is about mastering quickly what there is to know about the technical domain of the organization: products, markets, projects, technologies, and strategies. This is the easiest and fastest type of learning. In realignments and sustaining success situations, a different emphasis on learning is warranted early on, because you are dealing with people who are, or think they are, successful. They may not be hungry for change or for direction from you. Early mistakes, especially if they are interpreted as risking the traditional strengths of the business, will cost you dearly. The good news is that you will have time to learn. There is no need for urgent early action in realignments or sustaining success situations. You can afford to aim carefully before you fire your first critical shots. In realignments and sustaining success situations, you must delve deeply into organizational culture and politics. If, as was the case with Chris Bagley in the last chapter, you spend inadequate time understanding these dimensions of the organization, you will inevitably step on some landmines. As you've seen, learning about organizational politics and culture is hard work and takes time. Fortunately, you will have time if you give yourself permission to move cautiously and don't fall prey, as Claire Weeks did, to the action imperative. Offense versus defense. Early on, how much time should you spend on offensive planning, identifying new markets and developing new products and technologies, and how much on playing good defense, defending existing market share positions, buttressing existing positions, and extending existing products? Of course, you need to do both in all these situations, but the relative emphasis you should initially place on offense and defense differs greatly. For example, a startup is all about offense. You are there to get something new going, and there is usually nothing to defend. In a turnaround, by contrast, the early imperative is a good defense. You need to identify the remaining strengths of the organization and cut back to this defendable core that can help generate financial resources to support your next moves. Only then can you shift to offense and begin identifying and developing new platforms for growth. Realignments and sustaining success situations differ comparably. In a realignment, the agenda is to make mid-course corrections to take the business in new directions. You will still want to defend existing markets, but your best energies should be spent on the new offensive plan. In sustaining success situations, the key is to play good defense early on so you don't risk the crown jewels. Over time, you can gradually shift your attention to how you will take the organization to a new level. Figure 3-2, which is in the PDF document on the final CD of this program, depicts a matrix that summarizes where the early focus of energy should be in the four business situations. Securing early wins. To build momentum in your new job, you have to get some early wins. But what a win is differs dramatically among the four situations. In a startup, getting the right team in place and achieving strategic focus are key wins. Critically, you have to decide what you are not going to do, and then you have to discipline your organization not to do it. In turnarounds, getting the right team in place is also a key potential early win, as is identifying the defendable core of the business and making major progress in pairing the organization back to it. In realignments, gaining acceptance of the need for change and instilling a sense of urgency are often big early wins. Finally, in sustaining success situations, gaining and displaying understanding of what has made the organization successful is a key early win because it helps you win the right to make decisions about the organization's future. Diagnosing your portfolio. Your situation is unlikely to be a pure and tidy example of a startup, turnaround, realignment, or sustaining success situation. At a high level, your situation may fit reasonably neatly into one of these categories, but as soon as you drill down, you will almost certainly discover that you are managing a portfolio of products, projects, processes, plants, or people that represents a mix of the STARS situations. For instance, you may be taking over an organization that enjoys incremental growth with successful products and in which one group is launching a line of products based on a new technology. Or you may be working to turn around a company that has a couple of high-performing state-of-the-art plants. Your final diagnostic step, then, is to figure out which parts of your new organization belong in each of the four STARS categories. This exercise will help you to think systematically about challenges and opportunities in each piece. It will also supply you a common language with which to talk to your new team about why and how you are going to manage various pieces differently. Take the time to assign the pieces in your new portfolio, products, processes, projects, plants, and people, to the four categories using the figure 3-3, which is in the PDF document on the final CD of this program. Given this arrangement, how will you manage the various pieces differently? What do you need from them? What do they need from you? Rewarding success. The STARS framework has implications for how you should evaluate and reward the people who work for you. When groups of new leaders are asked to predict which types of transition is rewarded best and which the least when performed successfully in their organizations, turnarounds typically emerge as the best rewarded and realignments the least. This is not surprising. A successful turnaround is a visible and easily measurable individual accomplishment, as is a successful startup. In a realignment, by contrast, success consists of avoiding disaster. It is hard to measure results in a realignment. It is the dog that does not bite. Also, success requires painstakingly building awareness of the need for change, which often means giving credit to the group rather than taking it yourself. As for rewarding sustaining success, people seldom call their local power company to say, "Thanks for keeping the lights on today." But if the power goes off, the screaming is immediate and loud. There is a paradox inherent in rewarding people most lavishly for successful turning around failing businesses. Few high-potential leaders show much interest in realignments, preferring the action and recognition associated with turnarounds and startups. So who exactly is responsible for preventing businesses from becoming turnarounds? And does the fact that companies reward turnarounds and do not know how to reward realignments make it more likely that businesses will end in crisis in the first place? Skilled managers can seemingly count on less accomplished people to mess up businesses so they can come charging to the rescue. Claire Week's successor looked like a genius. The more general point, of course, is that performance must be rewarded differently in the different STARS situations. The performance of people put in charge of startups and turnarounds is easiest to evaluate because you can focus on measurable outcomes relative to some clear prior baseline. Evaluating success and failure in realignment and sustaining success situations is much more problematic. Performance in a realignment may be better than expected, but still poor. Or it may be that nothing much seems to happen because a crisis was avoided. Sustaining success situations pose similar problems. Success may consist of a small loss of market share in the face of concerted attack by competitors or the eking out of a few percentage points of top-line growth in a mature business. The unknown in both realignments and sustaining success situations is what would have happened if other actions had been taken or other people had been in charge. The as compared to what problem. Measuring success in such situations is much more work because you have to have a deep understanding of the challenges new leaders face and the actions they are taking in order to assess the adequacy of their responses. Adopting 4D development. Finally, consider using the STARS framework as a basis for selecting and developing people in your organization. This should be part of a broader, four-dimensional approach to high-potential talent development. The four dimensions are: number one, managerial functions; number two, geographic regions; number three, career crossroads; and number four, STARS business situations. Leading companies work hard to broaden the experience of their high-potential people among dimensions 1 and 2. Exposure to diverse management functions, for example, marketing, operations, human resources, and finance, and to international experience through overseas placements. Increasingly, companies are also managing leadership development along a third dimension, preparing managers for critical crossroads in their professional lives. As Ram Charan and his colleagues have noted, managers face critical breakpoints as they move from being first-time managers to managers of managers and all the way up to enterprise managers. As they move from one level to another, the rules and skill requirements change in significant ways. The fourth dimension of high-potential leadership development, breadth of exposure to different STARS business situations, should be directly addressed in succession and development planning. Do you want to develop different horses for different courses? For example, specialists in turnarounds and startups? Or do you want to develop people who can hunt and farm in a wide range of business situations? If the former, you should select specialists with the right inclinations and give them increasing responsibilities in those specific situations. If the latter, then your future general managers should get experience with a spectrum of business situations and you should coach them in how to succeed in each. A related issue is how best to bring in new people from outside the organization. Suppose you are planning to hire a high-potential person away from a competitor. Which of the four STARS situations would be most likely to set up that person to fail? The answer is realignment, because the new leader is put in the position of trying to convince people with whom he had once competed that they are not as good as they think they are. It would be surprising if the new leader were not resented, and insiders who thought they should have gotten the job will be sharpening their knives. Without the right attention and support, the likelihood that this person will fail is high. Acceleration checklist. Number 1. Which of the four stars situations are you facing? Startup, turnaround, realignment, or sustaining success? Number 2. What are the implications for the challenges and opportunities you are likely to confront, and for how you should approach accelerating your transition? Number 3. What are the implications for your learning agenda? Do you only need to understand the technical side of the business, or is it critical that you understand culture and politics as well? Number 4. Which of your skills and strengths are likely to be most valuable in your new situation, and which have the potential to get you into trouble? Number 5. What is the prevailing frame of mind? What psychological transformations do you need to make, and how will you bring them about? Number 6. Should your early focus be on offense or defense? Number 7. When you dig deeper, what is the mix of types of situations that you are managing? Which portions of your unit are in startup, turnaround, realignment, and sustained success modes? What are the implications for how you should manage and reward the people who work for you? Chapter 4, Secure Early Wins. When Elena Lee was promoted to head the telephone customer service unit of a leading retailer, she was determined to change the punitive, authoritarian managerial style of her predecessor. In her former job, she had been responsible for a smaller group in the same organization, so she knew a lot about the problems her new unit had been facing with quality of service. Convinced that she could dramatically improve performance through more employee participation and innovation, she saw cultural change as her top priority. Elena began by communicating her goals to employees. In a series of memos and small group meetings, she laid out her vision for a more participative, more problem-solving culture. These overtures met with skepticism from frontline employees and outright dismissal by some supervisors. Her next step was to begin twice weekly meetings with supervisors to review unit performance and seek input on how to improve it. Elena stressed that the punishment culture is a thing of the past and that she expected supervisors to coach employees. Cases involving discipline, she said, should be referred on an interim basis directly to her. Over time, Elena learned which supervisors were adjusting to the new arrangements and which were continuing to be punitive. She then conducted formal performance reviews and put two of the most recalcitrant supervisors on performance improvement plans. One left almost immediately. The other shaped up acceptably. Meanwhile, Elena focused on a critical aspect of the business, evaluation of customer satisfaction and the quality of service. She appointed her best supervisor and a couple of promising frontline people to a process improvement team and asked them to produce a plan to introduce new performance metrics and a non-punitive monitoring and coaching process. After tutoring them on how to pursue this project, she regularly reviewed their progress. When they presented recommendations, she promptly implemented them on a pilot basis in the section previously overseen by the departed supervisor. Elena promoted the most promising person on the process improvement team to supervise that section and to take ownership of the pilot program. By the end of her first year, Elena had extended the new process throughout the unit. Quality had improved substantially, and climate surveys revealed striking improvements to morale and employee satisfaction. Elena Lee succeeded in quickly creating momentum and building personal credibility. Early wins are the key to proving yourself quickly, as Dan Ciampa and I stressed in Right from the Start. By the end of your transition, you want your boss, your peers, and your subordinates to feel that something new, something good, is happening. Early wins excite and energize people and build your personal credibility. Done well, early wins help you to create value for your new organization earlier and therefore reach the break-even point much more quickly. Avoiding common traps. It is crucial to get early wins, but it is also important to secure them in the right way. Above all, of course, you want to avoid early losses because it is tough to recover once the tide is running against you. These are the most common traps that afflict unwary new leaders. Number 1. Failing to focus. It is all too easy to take on too much during a transition, and the results can be ruinous. You can end like Stephen Leacock's befuddled horseman, who flung himself on his horse and rode off madly in all directions. You cannot hope to achieve results in more than a couple of areas during your transition. Thus, it is essential to identify promising opportunities and then focus relentlessly on translating them into wins. Not taking the business situation into account. What constitutes an early win will differ dramatically from one business situation to another. Simply getting people to talk about the organization and its challenges can be a big accomplishment in a realignment, but a waste of time in a turnaround. Think tactically about what will build momentum best. Will it be a demonstrated willingness to listen and learn? Will it be rapid, decisive calls on pressing business issues? Not adjusting for the culture. Leaders who come into an organization from the outside are most at risk of stumbling into this trap. Having absorbed a different organization's culture, they bring with them its view of what a win is and how it is achieved. In some companies, a win has to be a visible individual accomplishment. In others, individual pursuit of glory, even if it achieves good results, is viewed as grandstanding and destructive of teamwork. In team-oriented organizations, early wins could come in the form of leading a team in the development of a new product idea or being viewed as a solid contributor and team player in a broader initiative. Be sure you understand what your organization does and does not view as a win. Number 3, failing to get wins that matter to your boss. It is essential to get early wins that energize your direct reports and other employees. But your boss's opinion about your accomplishments is critically important too. Even if you do not fully endorse his or her priorities, you have to make them central in thinking through what early wins you will aim for. Addressing problems that your boss cares about will go a long way towards building credibility and cementing your access to resources. Number 4, letting your means undermine your ends. Process matters. If you achieve impressive results in a manner that is seen as manipulative, underhanded, or inconsistent with the culture, you are setting yourself up for trouble. An early win that is accomplished in a way that exemplifies the behavior you hope to instill in your new organization is a double win. Making waves of change. Let us look at how the first few months of your transition fit into the larger picture of your full tenure in the new position. In a study of new general managers in various company settings, Jack Gabarro found that they typically plan and implement changes in distinct waves, illustrated in Figure 4-1, which is in the PDF document on the final CD of this program. Following an early period of acclimatization, they begin an early wave of changes. The pace then slowed to allow consolidation and deeper learning about the organization and to allow people to catch their breath. Armed with more insight, the new general managers then implemented deeper, more thoroughgoing, and structural wave of change. A final, less extreme wave focused on fine-tuning to maximize performance. By this point, most of these leaders were ready to move on. Gabarro's work has intriguing implications for managing transitions. First and most obviously, it suggests that you should devise your plan to secure early wins with your ends clearly in mind. The transition period lasts only a few months, but you will typically remain in the same job for 2 to 4 years before moving on to a new position. This 2 to 4 year period is your era in the organization, during which you will transition, make changes, and pursue your goals. To the greatest extent possible, your early wins should advance these longer-term goals. Planning your waves. In planning for your transition and beyond, it can be clarifying to plan to make successive waves of change. Each wave ought to consist of distinct phases: learning, designing the changes, building support, implementing the changes, and observing results. Thinking this way can release you to spend time up front to learn and prepare, and afterward to consolidate and get ready for the next wave. If you keep changing things, it is impossible to figure out what is working and what is not. Unending change is also a surefire recipe for burning out your people. The goal of the first wave of change is to secure early wins. The new leader tailors early initiatives to build personal credibility, establish key relationships, and identify and harvest low-hanging fruit, the highest potential opportunities for short-term improvements in organizational performance. Done well, this helps the new leader to build momentum and deepen his or her own learning. The second wave of change addresses more fundamental issues of strategy, structure, systems, and skills to reshape the organization. This is when the real gains in organizational performance are achieved, but you will not get there if you do not secure early wins in the first wave. Matching strategy to situation. Patterns of change differ radically with the different stars' situations. How would you expect the pace and intensity of waves of change to differ in startup, turnaround, realignment, and sustaining success situations? In more time-critical situations, startups and turnarounds, you should expect to begin your first wave of change earlier. The intensity of change, as perceived by people in the organization, will also probably be greater. In realignment and sustaining success situations, you can afford to take more time to learn and plan. If the business is genuinely in a sustaining success situation, you might plan several modest waves of change rather than a single big bang. Establishing long-term goals. In the first 90 days, a key goal is to build personal credibility and create organizational momentum. You do this by securing some early wins. Early wins leverage your energy and expand the potential scope of your subsequent actions. As you look for ways to create momentum, keep in mind that the actions you take to get early wins should do double duty. Plan your early wins so they help you build credibility in the short run and lay a foundation for your longer-term goals. Specifically, your efforts to secure early wins should, number one, be consistent with your A-item business priorities, and, number two, introduce the new patterns of behavior you want to instill in the organization. In other words, the process of pinpointing the early wins you want to go after begins with thinking about the longer-term changes you want to realize by the end of your era. Focusing on business priorities and behavioral changes. Your long-term goals should consist of A-item business priorities and desired changes in the behavior of people in your organization. A-item priorities constitute the destination you are striving to reach in terms of measurable business objectives. This destination could be double-digit profit growth or a dramatic cut in defects and rework. For Alina Lee, one A-item priority was significant improvements in customer satisfaction. The point is to define your goals so you can lead with a distinct endpoint in mind. Think about your legacy here. What do you want it to be? What do you want the letter announcing your promotion to your next job to say about what you did in this one? It is a useful exercise to write this letter. What would you want people to say about your achievements in this job at the end of 2 to 3 years? Defining your A-item priorities. How do you select your A-item priorities? You may have no choice. Your boss may simply hand them to you. But if you are able to shape your own agenda, or if think you need to negotiate goals with your boss, these guidelines may prove useful. Number one, A-item priorities should follow naturally from core problems. Establishing A-item priorities calls for pinpointing the critical areas in your organization that demand attention, as well as those that offer the greatest opportunities to contribute to dramatic improvement in performance. Alina Lee did this when she identified service quality as both a critical driver of performance and a goal that she could rally employees around. She might establish an A-item priority to increase customer satisfaction by 60% in 1 year. Number two, A-item priorities should be neither too general nor too specific. They should address several levels of specificity so you can establish measures and milestones along the way. For example, if your A-item priority is to condense the time it takes to get a new product from concept to customer, you should develop more specific, measurable, short-term steps to mark your progress towards that goal. At the same time, it probably isn't helpful to define daily goals for improving time to market. Number three, A-item priorities should offer clear direction yet allow for flexibility while you learn more about your situation. The process of defining your A-item priorities is iterative. You need to have a clear set of goals early on, but you must often test, refine, and restate those goals. You have to remain open to adjusting your objectives as you move along. For example, if you decide the distribution system is a key target for improvement, you might make it an A-item priority to get the products to customers 50% faster than before by the end of 18 months. This goal is ambitious, so success would have a big impact. But it is also broad enough that you have some flexibility to figure out how and where you will achieve it as you learn more. Targeting behavioral changes. If A-item goals are the destination, then the behavior of people in your organization is a key part of how you do or don't get there. Put another way, if you are to achieve your A-item priorities by the end of your era, you may have to address dysfunctional patterns of behavior. Start by identifying the unwanted behaviors. For example, Alina Lee wanted to reduce the fear and disempowerment in her organization. Then work out, as Alina did, a clear vision of how you would like people to behave by the end of your tenure in the job, and plan how your actions in pursuit of early wins will advance the process of behavior change. What behaviors do people in your organization consistently display that undermine the potential growth for high performance? Take a look at Table 4-1, which is in the PDF document on the final CD of this program, which lists some common but problematic behavior patterns, and then summarize your thoughts about the behaviors you would like to change.